and then page 148 in your folders. I have a few lessons on Philippians. If you'd like a copy, if you raise your hand, I'll be happy to bring you one. Anybody else? Okay, last one. All right, this is our last book to cover. We've got this for 9 months, Gospel of Luke, Book of Acts, and the 10 letters. Philippians is the last one. So tonight and then on Sunday, the Lord willing, we'll finish the quarter with these studies. All right. First point is the same as the other three have been, and that is we're putting this one with these last four letters as an epistle written from the first Roman imprisonment. The difference is that this one is not linked together with Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon because they were going to the same continent, if you will. Where was Philippi? What region? Macedonia, along with places like Berea and Thessalonica. Those would be Macedonian cities. Philippi was also a major city of Macedonia. And this letter is addressed to a local church, and not to say that the other local churches to whom Paul has written were not special to him. He did love those saints. I think that would be something that just could not be proven. But there are some statements in Philippians that are not found in, say, Ephesians and Colossians, the two letters to Thessalonica, Corinth, Rome, we've covered in this study. And we'll review some of those quickly tonight, and then as we get through, go through the text actually tonight, and on Sunday we'll again look at that as it's written in the book. But here are some statements that we can find that shows it was a group that was special to Paul. Who among them were the first converts? Back to Acts 16, Lydia was the first one that he came across. Remember when she was on the river bank with that group of women, they were outside praying. Paul met them and he converted her and her house. Also, of course, in Acts 16, when he was in the city, who did he baptize? The jailer and his house from Philippi. So, when this letter was written and then sent to Philippi and read, we can see in our minds, there sits Lydia and her house, there sits the jailer and his family when the letter is read. And also, we see that this church had been in fellowship with Paul. They had been very supportive of his preaching from the very start. Go to the last chapter of the book, chapter 4, and we have verses 15 and 16. Where Paul says that you yourselves, Philippians, you know something. He says, you know that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, except who? Except you. You were the only ones. For even in Thessalonica, when Paul was in Thessalonica, he said, you sent a gift. Some versions say once and again, or more than once. They did it more than one time. They would support Paul. And so even when no one else supported him, there was always Philippi. And you know that meant a lot to Paul. For reasons that we'll again emphasize when we come to the fourth chapter, when we're surveying the text itself. So they had been in league with Paul. They had been helping him all along. Now, it's almost 10 years later, and Paul is in a Roman prison. There he is. And what do? They send a gift again. This time, we know who the carrier was. Who was the one who brought Paul the gift? All right. In chapter 2, you'll see it was one named Epaphroditus. And we'll talk about him just in a few moments. They sent a gift for Paul's needs by Epaphroditus, chapter 2, 25 through 30. And then also another mention of Epaphroditus in chapter 4, verses 10 through 14, as well as verse 18. And Paul simply says, for example, verse 10 of chapter 4, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly now that at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity, but this time the gift came through. Drop down to verse 18. Again, he continues, but I have received everything in full and have an abundance. I am amply supplied, having received from Epaphroditus what you have sent. Verse 18, how did Paul view it? What did he call it? A sweet smelling, or some would say a fragrant aroma. That's how Paul thought about it. An acceptable sacrifice, and it's well pleasing to God. And then also the verses there in chapter 2, we mentioned 25 through 30. Again, mentioning Epaphroditus. The unique thing about Epaphroditus is what did Paul mention about him in this ministry to Paul in chapter 2? What happened to him? He got sick to what extent? To the point of death. But he would not quit. He kept on until he got to Rome and brought the gift to Paul. And so Paul writes this. One of the reasons he writes the letter, I would say it's one of the secondary reasons. The main one is to, of course, address the church, but also this letter was to tell them that Epaphroditus had been okay. He did not die. He made the trip to Rome, and he wanted them to know, the Philippians to know, that he was okay and was going to be bringing a letter back. We take the view that Epaphroditus was one who took the letter back from Rome to Philippi, to these Christians. So, likely written afterwards and carried back by Epaphroditus. So again, as we've been saying, Tychicus and Onesimus carried the other three letters, Ephesians, Colossians, and the short letter to Philemon. That goes to Asia Minor. Epaphroditus takes the letter to Philippi. And that's how they would, of course, split ways from Rome. So this chart is what we've been saying since we started these last four letters, how they were carried separately. Okay, again we see now, and I don't know that this may be by design, but I can't prove that it is. But in each of the four letters that we've been covering this last part of the Acts class, there have been three references in each letter to Paul as a prisoner, and this one is no different. There was three in Ephesians, three in Colossians, three in Philemon, and three in Philippians. Notice what he says, chapter 1 and verse 7. You'll see the phrase, in my imprisonment. So Paul was a prisoner. Verses 13 and 14 of the same chapter. Chapter 1, again, Paul mentions the word imprisonment, both places. And then also in chapter 1, and verse, they're all in the first chapter, and verse 17. Again, Paul mentions his imprisonment. So Paul is a prisoner. Now some Bible students will say this could have been when he was in Caesarea in prison. And was Paul imprisoned in Caesarea? Was he detained in Caesarea? Well, he was. Remember? It was in Caesarea. He stood before who? Felix and then Festus and Agrippa. It was in Caesarea he made his appeal to Caesar that set into motion the events that brought him to Rome. So someone says, okay, how do we know that these four letters were not written from Caesarean prison rather than a Roman prison? Well, that's certainly a position to consider. But I think we can say it's from Rome. And there's two main reasons that we're going to say this was from a Roman imprisonment, and they are both from the Philippian letter. Now, the first one, notice in chapter 1, verse 13, he mentions a Praetorian guard. You see there? Paul says, starting in verse 12, I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian guard. That was an elite group of soldiers that were stationed in Rome. And when prisoners all over the Roman Empire, if they made their appeal to Caesar, which a Roman citizen could do that, when they were thus transferred to Rome, guess who got custody of the prisoner? It's the Praetorian Guard. And they watched them and guarded them until their case came before the emperor. So that's one instance. Now, there was no Praetorian Guard in Caesarea. There were Praetoriums, or the governor's palace. There was even one of those in Jerusalem, because that's where Pontius Pilate was when Jesus was being tried. But there was no Praetorian Guard. That's only in Rome. The second indication is here in chapter 4 and verse 22, when Paul is bringing the letter to a close, and he's giving greetings to and from brethren. Those who were with him sent greetings, and then Paul wrote to brethren at Philippi. He wrote them greetings or peace, well wishes. Who does he mention in verse 22? He says, all the saints greet you, that is those who were with him. But who's he mentioned? Especially those of Caesar's house. Well, that rules out Caesarea. That's in Syria, Palestine. This is in Rome. So these two statements in the book tell us this had to be the Roman imprisonment, not the Caesarean imprisonment. But there's one more indicator to me that this is not from Caesarea. Go to chapter 1 of Philippians, and we'll cover this in a moment. Look, starting in verses... let's start in verse 20. Now let's start in verse 19. Rob, why don't you read for us, please, chapter 1, 19 through 24, and then we'll talk about this point we're going to make, these six verses. All right, that's good right there. Thank you. Now, based on these passages, what is Paul's expectation? What is he thinking? Well, that he may die, but really, he's believing that more one way than the other, what's really going to happen to him? I'm going to be released. I'm going to be released. I think we see that mainly from... verse 25, and convinced of this, I know that I shall remain. Now, even though he expects that to happen, what is a very real possibility? You just said it. He could die. He says that because in verse 20, all right, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that I shall not be put to shame in anything, but however it works out, Christ will be magnified in my body in what two ways? Either by life or by my death. Okay? If I am to live, verse 22, this will mean fruit label for you. But if I die, I get to go be with Christ. So, I'm just simply pointing out that at this juncture of the letter, though Paul is expecting to be released, that I think that's in his mind, but he does hold open the possibility, this may be the end for me. I may be a martyr for the cause of Christ at this place. So this delay, how long was he in Roman prison? The last part of Acts tells us. 2 years. He was there for 2 years. It took 2 years for his case to come before the emperor, Nero. So this delay of 2 years, Paul could have lost his life. Now, was Paul ever in such jeopardy in Caesarea? Was he going to be executed in Caesarea? There's no indication of that in the book of Acts at all. In fact, the only reason for the delay in Caesarea back in Acts 24 was, what was Festus wanting? He's looking for a bride. That's why he kept Paul in prison 2 years, and then he got displaced. The Bible doesn't say why, but secular history, Josephus tells us, in shame, the emperor replaced him with Festus. I mean, Thetis. I said Festus. Felix was looking for the bride, and Festus came afterwards. So during that 2 year stay in Caesarea, Paul wasn't thinking like this. Well, I may die here. That was he didn't appear to ever be in that kind of jeopardy. But that was the case with the Roman imprisonment. So these factors, I think, lead us to believe this was written from Rome and not from the Caesarean prison term when he was there. Both lasted 2 years. It's just that I think the letter comes from Rome and not from Caesarea. So that's something that we need to consider when we're trying to date the book. Okay. Paul wanted to know about the Philippians since he last saw them on the third journey. And so as you'll see in chapter 2, verses 19 through 23. Who did he send? He sent Timothy. And why did he send Timothy? He gives the reason why in verse 20. Because I've got no one else of like kindred mind or like kindred spirit. Paul seems to be saying, I don't trust anybody else like I would trust Timothy to be sent on this journey and to come and inquire about you and to find out about how your condition is. He trusted Timothy that much. So Paul did want to know about them, and so he did send his younger comrade in the gospel to Philippi to find out about their condition. Again, as we mentioned on Sunday when we just went through Philemon, expectations in that letter as well as in this letter, this is the only two of the four prison letters that tell us that Paul had a reasonable expectation he was going to be released. What was it that he had said to Philemon that gave us that expectation? What did he ask toward the end of the letter? Yeah, make me a room. Well, you're not going to ask to have a room prepared for you if you're not going to go. That just wouldn't make sense. And in this letter, chapter 1, 19 through 20, 25 through 26, and chapter 2 are indications. In fact, look in chapter 2, when he's talking about sending Timothy, what does he say especially in verse 24? I'm going to try to come myself. I'm sending Timothy, but I hope to come too. Now again, possibility he could lose his life, but he was expecting to be released, and that being the case, he would also go to Philippi upon his release. Okay. briefly and overall, I think we can see the letter as a thank you letter. Because again, this is from to a group of saints that meant so much to Paul. He's got a lot to thank them about. And so there are several statements of gratitude in the letter. Personal expressions, this is the bottom of page 148, personal expressions of gratitude for all that they did as a group of Christians. And then there are also various exhortations in the epistle for them to live faithfully for the Lord, living for the cause of Christ. All right, that's just real briefly a quick rundown in terms of an overview or an overall assessment of the letter without getting into the text itself. Now let's turn to page 149 and start looking at the text. I don't think, in my mind, I don't think Philippians is as easy to outline as, say, Ephesians or Colossians was. Maybe somebody can help me with that. But I see it's harder to outline for me. And so hopefully using what we're providing here will help us make more sense of the book. It means a little more to us than just a vague letter. So let's look at the epistle. The first section seems to be verses 1 through 11. These are as Paul's habit is, or his nature was, he began a letter. He would send out some opening greetings, expressions of gratitude, thankfulness from his heart to whoever it is that he's writing to. So notice especially what he says here. Verse 3, opening statement. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you. Verse 4 again, what does he mention that he does with respect to the Philippians, or for the Philippians? He prays for them. Paul prays. I imagine, here we are again. Here's this man. He's in prison. And what's he doing on behalf of other Christians? He's praying for them. praying for him. Shows us his heart, if you will. Verse 7, he says, I have you in my heart. It is only right for me to feel this way about you all because I have you in my heart, since both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you all are partakers of grace with me. And he says in verse 8, that I long for you with all the affection of Christ Jesus. Now, Paul didn't make statements like this to other Christians. Again, that doesn't mean he didn't love other brethren, but these are germane to this letter. Paul really felt a close kinship to the Christians in Philippi, and that is contained in the opening statements of this letter. So he says then in verse 9, his prayer for them is what? Well, that your love may abound, your love may increase still more and more in real knowledge and in all discernment, so that you may approve the things that are excellent in order to be sincere and blameless until when? Until the day that Christ comes back. That's right. Having been filled with the fruit of righteousness, which comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and the praise of God. So a very moving opening statement, if you will, of how Paul feels about these Christians. Now, having said that, here's his opening remarks to them personally. Now, we start in verse 12, and Paul's going to talk about, next you'll see, he wants to talk about his present condition, being in prison in Rome, and not just that, but really how that has had an impact upon the gospel, his efforts to work for Christ. Now, let's step outside the book just for a moment. Let's use some conventional human wisdom. I know that's far inferior to the wisdom of God, but let's do it anyway. Here is Paul. He's in prison. Conventional human wisdom says, here is an apostle whose job is to go about preaching, spreading Christianity, starting churches, whatever. He's in prison. Now, how much good is he going to be able to do? Conventional human wisdom. Not much. And so if you're writing this letter, if you were given the right or the privilege of writing somebody a letter, okay, you're in prison for the cause of which you labor. Typically, a person would say, I'd like to do a whole lot more, but I'm kind of stuck here. You know, I'm confined. I can't do a whole lot. Not much preaching. I mean, I can speak to my fellow prisoners, but that's about the length of my audience right there. I can't go any farther than that. And this shows us the power of God. That isn't the argument Paul makes. Yes, his prison has impacted the gospel, but in what way? For the worse or for the better? Look what he says. Look at the points that he makes. And see, that tells us, brethren, something, is that the God we serve through His providence, you can't limit God. Bad conditions may come upon any one of us. But when that happens, what are we supposed to do? Just kind of be like a turtle and crawl up in our shell and not do anything? Who knows what that we can't use those adverse conditions, just like what Paul suffered, and we can still find ways to help and to aid the cause of Christ. Paul certainly did. But sometimes when we get in those adverse conditions, what do we usually throw ourselves? We throw ourselves a pity party, don't we? We just kind of get all dried up and then we stop trying. We don't try as hard as we did, say, when we were free or outside those adverse conditions. And Paul's not that way. So this is a great, great section. Very powerful section of the letter. Yes. Yes, he did. He sure did. To the Praetorian Guard. He didn't quit trying, did he, Brother Tom? Kept preaching. That's the lesson. Very good. Okay, so Paul begins this section, verse 12. He says, I want you to know, I would have you know, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, or the greater advancement of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ, that is to say, I think he means, the reason for my imprisonment. Now, obviously the guard would know he's a prisoner. That's their job to watch him. But they may not know why he's there. I mean, people could have been in prison for all sorts of reasons in the Roman Empire. The Praetorian Guard, they didn't care why he's there. They just had to watch the prisoner. But they didn't know the reasons why. But Paul's having him know why he's there, why he's been in prison. And so he says, "My imprisonment," verse 13, "in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to other places," or mine says to everyone else. Everyone's finding out Paul is in prison in Rome because he's been preaching the gospel. That's why he's in prison. And so here's the reasons why Paul's imprisonment has not hindered him, has not kept him from preaching, has not stifled the gospel, but it's actually helped him. He's going to outline those reasons right here. First one he says is what? Well, the Praetorian Guard knew of Paul now. Secondly, what about others who had heard of Paul's imprisonment? What did they do? Yeah, verse 14. That's right, Doug. "And most of the brethren, trusting in the Lord because of my imprisonment," he says, "they now have far more courage or far more boldness to speak the Word of God without fear." Imagine that. Why would what happened to Paul make someone else more bold? Why would it work that way? I'm sorry? Okay, Paul's an example. Paul has been traveling the whole ancient world, making Christians, or not, he didn't make the Christians, but he was preaching and teaching, starting churches in the work of the Lord. And so he was an example. Norm, that's the best word to use. And so others who have learned, maybe at the feet of Paul, he taught them, they heard him preach, they saw what's happened to him, and if they're convicted of the truth, and I think the phrase here, verse 14, "those who trust in the Lord." Okay? Those who are faithful and trusting servants of the Lord, when they hear what happened to Paul, they would say, "Well, that's what I need to be doing. I mean, if Paul loves the Lord enough to go through that, then surely I need to be as busy or as busy as I can be in the kingdom also." And so they became more bold, and that resulted in more people preaching the gospel. So that helps. That's one of the things that he mentions. All right, what else does he mention as another reason why his imprisonment has not only not stifled the gospel, but it's worked out for its advancement? Starting in verse 15. These who are speaking out more boldly. He describes them in two ways. What's the two groups? All right. Some were preaching. More were now involved in preaching. And Paul realizes now there can be two motives at work here. Some could be preaching out of envy and strife. Now, why would a person be envious? What would be the reason to have envy of Paul? Oh, I wish I was in jail. Would you think that? That's it, Albert. Paul was getting some attention. And if you have a carnal attitude or a carnal mind, well, everybody's talking about Paul. Paul's getting all the headlines. I mean, if they had newspapers and the internet back there and all that kind of business and TV and radio, and everybody's talking about Paul. Paul, 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 Paul. That's all I hear about. And some would say, "Well, you know, I won't be talked about. And so maybe I'll get involved in this business and they'll start talking about me." That would be from an envious standpoint. Or that would, of course, be the bad motive. The good motive is what he mentions? Goodwill. Now, someone says, "Well, you know, if you're going to be this kind of person that's envious because Paul's getting all the headlines and you're getting into preaching just to be talked about, then you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't be out there preaching." How does Paul address that in this letter? What's he say? He said, "I don't care what the motive is, really. As long as you're out there preaching..." Now, of course, if they're preaching error, that's different. But if they're out there preaching the truth, I don't care why they're preaching it. If what I'm going through gets more people involved in spreading the Word of God, I don't care why they're doing it. That was his attitude. I think that's very commendable. That's at least what he says. This is verses 15 through 18. He says, "Some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife, but some also from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, rather than from pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. What then?" Verse 18. "Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in this I rejoice, yes, and I will rejoice." Paul didn't care. He really didn't care. Now, should a person have the right motive behind doing the right thing? Yes, of course. But Paul, being in the condition that he was, he's just simply saying, okay, the cause of Christ, me being in jail here, being in prison, has not just thwarted the entire movement for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Actually, my condition has done just the opposite. It's made it a lot more active. It's actually helped it. It's actually aiding it. Yes, as Paul, I know some have the wrong motivation, the wrong attitude. I know that. But hey, Christ is getting preached. That's all I really care about. And that's really the point that he's making, at least down through verse 18. Yes. Yes. That's a good point, Rob. If someone who's preaching the Word of God out of the wrong motivation, but if they preach the truth and convert someone and that person obeys, well, the motive was wrong, but what still happened? Someone still obeys. It's still the Word of God getting taught, truthfully and faithfully. And that's a good observation to make. So Paul's just simply saying, I won't tell you about my condition. It's not hindering the gospel. It's actually working out for the advancement of the cause of Christ. And that's a good thing. So once again, who is Paul not thinking about? Himself. That's been the example time after time after time. When he was in Caesarea and being judged by Felix and by Festus and by Agrippa, and he was given the chance to defend himself, what did he usually speak about? He spoke about the gospel. Here he is now in prison, and again, he could have thrown this huge pity party, woe is me kind of attitude, and he's still thinking about the gospel. He's just a great man, worthy of our adoration and our imitation. Yes, sir. Yes. 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 And Paul knew he was in a position to be a leader. Your point in verse 17, people were talking about Paul, as he puts it toward the end of the verse 17, to cause me distress in my imprisonment, to make me feel even worse than I am. But Paul says, look, you know, I'm not going to really get worked up over that, because they're talking about me, they're talking about the gospel, they're talking about the kingdom. And if talking about all that results in someone obeying the gospel, that's fine with me. But that's a great point to make, Gary. Thank you. Okay. So that's how he talks about how his condition is not only not helping the gospel. So Paul says, Christ is going to be exalted. I'm going to see to it that in all that I've got, all the things that I'm in charge of, Christ is going to be exalted in me, either in my life, if I'm allowed to live. For me to live is Christ. Everything I do every day, every action, every thought, every motive, Paul says, on my behalf, Christ will be exalted in my body, all my actions. What's the other alternative? If not life, it's death. and even in my death. If this is the end for me, what was Paul's attitude? Same thing. I want Christ to be exalted in my death. Pardon? Yes, and Paul says, now I'm torn between the two. Okay, if I stay on, if I'm allowed to remain, who does that benefit, does he say? Them. It benefits the Philippians. Because I intend to come to you after I'm released. But if I die, who's that benefit? That benefits me. I get to go be with the Lord. So for to me to live is Christ, to die is gain. Very familiar statement from Philippians 1. There you see in verse 21. But Paul's attitude was, it doesn't matter what happens to me, I want Christ to be exalted in me, whether by life or by death. And I wish that we would think the same. We need to think the same. Just exactly what Paul's thinking. That needs to be our attitude also. Good point to remember. So, Paul's situation, how it was going to be resolved, he says the results would be victorious either for him personally, go be with Christ, or for the Christians in Philippi, verses 21 through 26. And verse 25 seems to conclude the idea that Paul's expectation was, he says, I am convinced of this, that I know I shall remain. That is to say, I won't suffer martyrdom, at least not yet. I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that your proud confidence in me may abound in Christ through my coming to you again. So Paul's thinking is, I'm going to get out of this. This isn't going to be the end for me, and I will come to you again. So that's the end of the first main section following the greetings, if you will. Now, starting in chapter 1, verse 27, through chapter 2, verse 18, I see three main exhortations Paul gives them. And we'll take them, these statements, right from the text. I think there's one at the start of each main section. This is toward the middle of the page now, page 149. What's the first main exhortation he gives, starting in verse 27? What's he say? All right. Let your conduct or conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel. I say that's a mouthful right there, isn't it? How you interact before your neighbors, before your co-workers, before your family, spouse, children, other related family members, before your brethren. How you behave when you're doing business or commerce with somebody out in the world. Whatever. Okay. Whatever conduct you involve yourself in, what's the rule of thumb for Christians? Conduct yourselves in a manner that is worthy of the gospel of Christ. So when someone asks you, not that you'd ever get this question, but let's just say you did, why do you act the way you do? I've been watching you, I hear the words you say, or really I don't hear you say these kinds of words. I see how you're dressed, I see how you behave, all these things. I've noticed this about you. And I was just curious, why do you act the way that you do? Well, what would you tell them? This is the reason why. I'm trying to conduct myself in a manner worthy of the gospel. It's the gospel of Christ that taught me how to live. It's the gospel of Christ that called me out of sin into His marvelous life. And I need to live. That's my standard. That's why I live the way I do. And so Paul says, whatever you do, whatever your conduct is, well, yes, they do, but it may not be that blunt. But, I mean, I've been asked that kind of question before, and maybe some of you have also, by co-workers or friends who aren't Christians. You know, why you don't go to drinking parties, and why you don't go to the office parties, and why you don't go do this, don't go do that, and why you don't go see this kind of movie. And all these things can come into play. Well, why do you do that? In fact, aren't there verses that say that, you know, people will ask you, they may malign you, they may speak evil of you, all those things can happen. And so we're having these ready-made situations, if you will, where we can give a defense for the gospel or for the hope that's in us with meekness and fear, 1 Peter 3 and verse 15. So here's the first main exhortation. Paul says, conduct yourself in a manner. So this section concludes. He says, verse 27, whether I come to you or remain absent, whether I'm there or not, did the Philippians need Paul there to behave this way? Well, of course not. But he says, whether I come or whether I do not come, I want to hear that you stand firm in one spirit, with one mind striving together for the cause or for the faith of the gospel. In a word, what's that? He says, I want you to be unified. I want you to believe and teach and say the same thing. That's the first man exhortation. Okay. Class is over. We'll have to stop here. So we'll have to finish up Sunday. We've got a lot.